And there's no reason to rush to carry out these executions by the end of April when other drugs are available. And even this drug continues to be available to other states. And so it's really a manufactured situation that can be avoided.
Megan McCracken, we want to thank you for being with us, attorney with the Death Penalty Clinic at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And that does it for our broadcast. Check our job listings at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wales, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Ndura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book, which chronicles the 15 years of successful community organizing to create the progressive transformation of Richmond, California. Again, that's A Night with Steve Early, Monday, March 20th at the Portland State University Bookstore at 1715 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 5:01, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council passes an anti-disruption ordinance.
The Oregon House Health Care Committee held its first public hearings on the Reproductive Health Equity Act.
A Milwaukee middle school teacher has been arrested on drug possession charges.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, the Ides of March, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. A Milwaukee middle school teacher has been arrested on drug possession charges. Bryn Marie Fletcher, a 33-year-old special education teacher at Alder Creek Middle School, was arrested and charged with possession of heroin and methamphetamines. According to school officials, Fletcher was seen repeatedly walking to her car in the school parking lot. A school administrator observed what appeared to be drug paraphernalia in the car and notified the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. The teacher was arrested and is being held in Clackamas County Jail. Bail was set at $30,000. Fletcher had worked within the North Clackamas School District since 2012 and at Alder Creek Middle School since 2014. Prior to being hired, she had undergone a background check which revealed no criminal history.
After a contentious meeting with many disruptions, the Portland City Council passed Mayor Ted Wheeler's ordinance to restore order to council meetings. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this report.
A lengthy city council meeting ended amid protests early this afternoon as the council voted to pass Mayor Ted Wheeler's anti-disruption ordinance. The ordinance was previously discussed both at last week's council session and during the Friday listening session hosted by the mayor and councilwoman Amanda Fritz. The measure's most controversial provision is one that allows consistent disruptors to be barred from the meeting for 60 days, but Wheeler promised not to act on that until approved by the courts, as he tried to reassure attendees that the intent was not to restrict free speech.
This ordinance does not in any way limit the current testimony, the public testimony, public access to the city council in any way. Moreover, other than this ordinance, we've also been talking about ways to expand current access both to me as the mayor and to the city council.
However, when it came time for Councilwoman Amanda Fritz to cast her vote, the crowd expressed its displeasure loudly.
People are not coming to city council chambers because they are afraid of being abused.
Later, Councilwoman Chloe Udaly admonished the crowd and explained why the ordinance is needed.
The disruptive, disrespectful, and toxic discourse that has become the norm at our city council sessions are creating a hostile work environment for us and for our staff. It is keeping the council from doing the public's work in a timely fashion. It is wasting public dollars, and it is discouraging and preventing participation by other community members.
The ordinance goes into effect in 30 days. At this point, there is no estimate on when or even if the court will rule on the controversial provision. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Today, Oregon House Healthcare Committee was scheduled to hold its first public hearings on House Bill 2232, the Reproductive Health Equity Act. The bill would ensure access to free birth control and require health insurers to cover other reproductive health services, including preventative care, prenatal care, breastfeeding support, and testing for sexually transmitted diseases. The bill also covers abortions, a procedure currently covered by many but not all of Oregon's insurers. Supporters of the bill say that it would remove barriers to family planning for all women and guarantees that Oregonians have coverage for all preventative reproductive services with no out-of-pocket cost. The bill, which has the support of 19 representatives and 10 senators so far, was scheduled for 3 p.m. today. A full vote has not yet been scheduled.
As climate change worsens, certain landscapes could become refuge from the most dramatic effects of nature. One conservation group is looking to harness the power of these refuges by protecting them. Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service has more.
As climate change worsens, certain landscapes could become refuges from the most dramatic effects to nature. One conservation group is looking to harness the power of those refuges by protecting lands that will be more resilient as global temperatures rise. The Nature Conservancy has created maps covering more than 350,000 square miles of land in the Northwest that it has identified as especially sustainable in the decades to come. With the help of $6 million from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, the organization is working with local land trusts to protect these lands. Katie Volke, head of the North Coast Land Conservancy in Oregon, says connecting landscapes is key.
As the climate changes and species need to shift up or down or around, there's space for them to do that.
Volke's organization has received $200,000 from the Nature Conservancy to preserve and connect part of the region near Tillamook Head on Oregon's coast. Organizations must match the Conservancy's funding 5-1. The funds are used to purchase private lands or work with owners on use-limiting easements. Ken Popper is senior conservation planner with the Nature Conservancy. He says climate change is going to mean big shifts for many species. Rather than running climate models over the next few decades, the Conservancy identified areas in the Northwest that were more diverse in terms of soil, slope, and elevation, qualities that aren't likely to change even as the climate changes. Popper says the lands that are most resilient are those that host the most microhabitats.
And those places can both serve as refugia for species that are there now, or in some ways opportunities for species in the future.
Most of the resiliency mapping in the Northwest covered Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A bill introduced in the state legislature would add Oregon to a national movement to reform the nation's presidential elections. House Bill 2927 would award Oregon's Electoral College votes to the winner of the national popular vote under an interstate agreement, but only after states with a majority of the Electoral College have passed similar legislation. So far, 10 states and the District of Columbia have passed the bill, which is a workaround to the requirement for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to abolish the Electoral College. The Constitution also allows states to award their electoral votes in a manner of their choosing. Similar legislation has passed the Oregon House three times, but has been defeated each time in the Senate. Hillary Clinton won 2.9 million more votes than Donald Trump in November, but lost the Electoral College.
On Tuesday evening, local youth-led advocacy group Millennio called a gathering at the Portland Mercado in Southeast Portland to bring community together to address mass incarceration and deportation in Oregon. In addition to food, drink, and conversation, speakers comprising a Millennio project called Policy Network shared personal anecdotes and spoke about organizing work currently being done to resist state oppression from the grassroots. Here are some clips of the speakers present last night.
One of the things I battle for every day is for my undocumented students. As a teacher, I am one of two Latino employees in my building, even though almost 35% of our student body is Latino. And that burden for me, which I accept greatly, is that the students who have the strength and courage to come out as undocumented, I end up being the door that they have to come in, right? And I accept that challenge to help connect them with the resources that they have and to help get them into feeling accepted in their communities, and also get them to think about their lives moving forward, right? Whether that's attending college, whether that's seeking their careers, but knowing that they have a role to play in our society.
We want to make sure that we create an informative hub for our communities, not only here in Portland, across the nation, and globally. We want to make sure that we change the narrative and that this language, this dehumanizing language, stops. We allow people to come into this country and we allow them to remain who they are. We don't want them to assimilate. We don't want them to whitewash themselves. We don't want them to forget where they come from and who they are and who their families are. We want them to acculturate. We want to continue to make this country great by bringing in knowledge, bringing in skills, bringing in culture. And one way that we do that is we try and steer the populace to information that's factual. And when we're on that bus and we see some people being abused verbally, we have the internal motivation and the best approach to start a dialogue with our community members. Because the only way things are going to change is if we don't hide, and if we actually speak up, and we speak up in a respectful way, and we speak up with the truth.
There's one program that I don't know if anybody saw. There was a press release just a couple of weeks ago that's Multnomah County just enacted a new program called the LEAD program. And what that means is law enforcement assisted diversion. And what that amounts to is, in Multnomah County, if you're somebody on the street that is basically going to either get brought in on a misdemeanor possession charge or something like that, you now have an option. And the officers in Multnomah County, no matter what jurisdiction they're from or which law enforcement agency they're working with, they should now be telling you that you can either come in and get booked, or instead I can actually connect you with a social worker right now in real time and option you with talking to somebody with addiction services, talk to somebody around emergency housing, and basically address all of those other things if you're willing to show up for these appointments. And that means you don't get charged with a crime anymore. So that's a really cool thing, and you should look into it. It's a really big success for Multnomah County. It's one of very few places, in fact, one of 10 communities in the whole country that's doing this right now.
It's infuriating to see the pain that kids have, because when you're 14 years old and you're spouted hate, right? When people throw racial slurs at you when you're, say, 13, it's a hard world to realize that you live in. And for me, at times, it makes me feel helpless in a sense. But with that said, right, I know that I need to give back. I know that I need to use my opportunity that's been provided to me to be able to reach out and provide some semblance of hope for individuals that are reaching out for that hand, right?
And that's looking at my parents in the face when a Muslim student's needing to have a conversation, or that's looking at my mom or my brother, who is a gay Latino man, in the face, right? Whenever I am, tasked with that choice, because we all make that choice of whether we're going to look the other way or not, right? I think about how often Portland loves to talk about how liberal it is, and since I'm an outsider, I'm going to talk ish. About how liberal and progressive it is, and cool, like maybe sure, but I always think about, and it's a story that's always burns in the back of my mind. I think about the story, I think it was on the Max, right around the election, when some like racist dude was like spouting some stuff at a woman, right? And the Max or the bus, whatever it was pretty packed. Like there was probably, like you can see it from the video, that there were a solid 20 people in there with them, right? And the people who decide to stand up and actually denounce the hate that this dude is spewing are three, 15-year-old Latino boys, right? And then I asked that question because if you confronted everybody else on that Max, right, like you would get 100% replies that those people are progressives, right? Maybe they all voted for or against 45. They would tell you that they, like if you brought up a social issue, they would probably be like 100% for it. But they sat there and they watched, and they sat there and they were complicit, and they sat there and allowed that to happen, right? That's where you step in.
You just heard speakers addressing the issues of deportation and mass incarceration at last night's gathering at the Portland Mercado. The event was organized by local organization Millennio's Policy Network. More information about the Policy Network can be found by searching for millennio.org on Facebook or heading to their webpage at www.millennio-2016.org.
Thinking about healthcare, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wonders, if not now, when?
When they say 24 million people losing health care is those people's choice. When they say the cost of the average health care plan will go down without saying that's because the older and preconditioned will no longer have plans because of the skyrocketing costs. When those saying no to us have the best, cheapest medical plan available. When conservatives say Trump care is too generous. I'm waiting for when meanness no longer rules, when votes count more than dollars, when we get Medicare for all, when billionaires pay a higher tax rate than I do. Until then, I get my insurance from Mutual of Jericho till the walls come tumbling down. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:45, followed by What's Life Without Laughter at 6 and Free Culture Radio at 6:30. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for morning showers giving way to partial sun in the afternoon. Temperatures will reach the mid-50s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a partly cloudy day with temperatures in the upper 50s. On this day in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson addressed a joint session of Congress to urge the passage of legislation guaranteeing voting rights for all. 5 months later, Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. The law was severely weakened by a Supreme Court decision in 2013, which ruled that a key provision was unconstitutional. Our quote of the day is from Sherilyn Eiffel, director of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. In reference to the court's decision, she said, quote, "Today will be remembered as a step backwards in the march towards equal rights. We must ensure that this day is just a page in our nation's history rather than a return to a dark chapter."
Well, it's 5:18. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's time to state the obvious. The President of the United States is deranged. I don't mean he's merely idiosyncratic, nor do I say this as a political jab. I mean that Donald J. Trump literally is mentally ill. Okay, I'm no doctor, but you don't need a doctorate in mental disorders to see that his behavior in public and on Twitter is beyond abnormal. It's psychotic. As we've seen, he routinely plunges into prolonged fits of petty paranoia. He succumbs to delusions of imperialist grandeur. He spouts ridiculous right-wing rumors as facts and denies that actual facts are true. And he is pathologically addicted to lying, bizarrely repeating his most blatant fabrications even after they've been totally debunked. A sane, temperamentally balanced president, possessing all the power and majesty that America's supreme office conveys, doesn't get into demeaning public snits with the likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger, doesn't feel a constant need to puff himself up with ridiculously false claims, such as his frantic insistence that the crowd at his inaugural celebration was the largest ever, doesn't rage rabidly at media outlets that displease him, blasting them as enemies of the people, and does not unleash a furious all-out attack on Barack Obama just because some radio talk show screwball made a proof-free claim that the former president had wiretapped Trump's campaign. This is Jim Hightower saying, these are not mere eccentricities, not just Trump being Trump. It's obvious that the guy is not well and is unable to handle the stress of being president. Indeed, his flaky behavior suggests he's on the brink of a personal breakdown, and his ever more frequent retreats to his posh Florida golf resort tells us he doesn't even want to do the job. His loved ones and his party should intervene for his sake and for America's, but they won't. So, will we?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Yesterday's disclosure of a small portion of Donald Trump's 2005 federal income tax filings offers a rare look at the personal finances of the current president. The tax forms were anonymously sent to David K. Johnson, a former New York Times reporter, and disclosed on The Rachel Maddow Show later on MSNBC. K., the author of The Making of Donald Trump, told Ms. Maddow that he had received the forms over the transom and that he did not know who had sent them to him. He even suggested that they might have been sent by Trump himself. The documents show that Trump reported an income of $150 million and then wrote off $100 million in business losses. He ended up with a net tax bill of $38 million and effective tax rate of 25%. None of the supporting schedules were included with the Form 1040, so it was not possible to see the detail of the losses or to trace any additional business connections. It was interesting to note, however, that $31 million of Trump's tax bill was based on the alternative minimum tax calculation. The alternative minimum tax was instituted to ensure that wealthy individuals could not completely dodge their taxes. On the campaign trail, Mr. Trump stated that the alternative minimum tax was something that he would like to do away with.
Georgia has become the latest state to take up legislation seemingly designed to have a chilling effect on First Amendment rights. Georgia's state Senate passed SB1 earlier this month, and the bill is now before the lower house of the state's General Assembly. It goes further than many of the other so-called anti-protest bills introduced in other states by expanding the legal definition of domestic terrorism and creating a state-level Department of Homeland Security with surveillance and intelligence-sharing capabilities. For more on SB1 and its implications, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Azeda Shashani, legal and advocacy director at Project South, a grassroots social justice organization based in Atlanta.
Let's start with what this bill is purported to fight, which is domestic terrorism. How does this bill define domestic terrorism, and how does it change the definition already in law?
So it widely expands the definition of domestic terrorism in a way that would allow law enforcement to target groups of citizens who demonstrate in public places. So for one thing, it vaguely suggests that efforts to advance any belief could be categorized under a new definition of domestic terrorism. And it also broadens the definition of terroristic threats to include actions, quote, with the purpose of otherwise causing serious public inconvenience. And the concern is there is no clear definition of a public inconvenience, and there is no clarity on who or what agency gets to define what this entails. So obviously, we are concerned that this bill will be used as a mechanism to further crack down on the rights of people who want to exercise their First Amendment right to protest.
Thrown in at the end of one of the sections of the legislation is, quote, "This code section shall not apply to constitutionally protected speech or lawful assemblies." Do you find that reassuring?
No. That language is there, but if there is some type of an activity, potentially violent activity at one of the protests, other people at the protest who may not be, really involved or behind the violent action could similarly get targeted. So, that language in the context of a broad bill that is designed to crack down on freedom of speech provides no assurance to us.
Now, you've outlined your concerns about the right to peaceably assemble and the right to protest. What about due process concerns?
Right. So agencies under this bill will be required to share information about known or suspected terrorists, and SB1 provides no access to the right to due process for anyone on this list to appeal mistakes or to be removed from this list. I mean, already we've seen what has happened with the no-fly list and the various watch lists on the federal level, where there was, zero to minimum due process for people who were often mistakenly placed on this list, and how really, their lives were wrecked on multiple levels. And so now we're seeing basically a copying of this at the state level.
The bill has lengthy sections on surveillance and subpoena powers. Can you sum up some of the broader points?
Right. So this new Department of Homeland Security that is going to be established on the state level has been empowered with basically monitoring and sharing information about people who could be suspected of engaging in acts of terrorism. So, already we're seeing on the local level, especially a move towards monitoring free speech activities. So just a few weeks ago, we heard reports about Muslim activists being approached by local police and interrogated for, half an hour about their political beliefs. And then when we followed up with them, the local police mentioned that this is part of an outreach effort. So, which very much sounds like massive surveillance efforts to us. And so the concern is that, this new legislation with this new Department of Homeland Security, with a new commissioner, all of the new officials that are going to be based there are going to have even more power to surveil our immigrant, Muslim, and activist communities.
Some have painted this legislation as an anti-hate crimes bill. And this comes as Jewish community centers and mosques around the country have reported incidents ranging from bomb threats to arson to vandalism. There have been cases of South Asian immigrants who have been targeted by violence by perpetrators mistaking them for Muslims. Do you see the political will in Georgia to go after hate crimes? And is this bill conceivably part of that?
Unfortunately, I don't think this bill is going to do anything on that front. I think the hate crimes and unfortunate hateful rhetoric that we're seeing targeted by, hate groups at our communities is very much tied to the hateful and racist and Islamophobic rhetoric that has been coming down the federal level, since before the elections. I mean, you can't divorce the two. So, we have a president who has made it a priority to target, both in terms of rhetoric and in terms of policies, Muslim communities and communities of color and queer and trans people. And so there should be no surprise when our communities are actually physically attacked.
Now, on a personal level, as an immigrant from one of the Muslim majority nations on the travel ban list, did you ever imagine seeing something like this transpire in the U.S.?
We've seen this happen before. We saw the internment of Japanese Americans in relatively recent history. We've seen, murder of black individuals by the police. We've seen the crackdown against indigenous communities that are claiming their right to their natural resources. You know, we have seen evidence of this trend of repression coming, and you know, most disturbingly was a comment by an advisor to Trump after the elections, saying something to the effect that internment of Japanese Americans was okay given the circumstances. I don't ever remember hearing anybody legitimize that in recent history. So you know, I think we should really look back closely at the history of this country and the repression that has happened, and learn from the resistance that has been able to fight back. And so, you know, not be surprised, but be prepared to fight back.
Azadeh Shashahani is the legal and advocacy director at Project South. She joined me by phone from Atlanta, Georgia. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
In Florida, convicted felons are prohibited from voting even after completing their sentence. The recently introduced Voter Restoration Amendment is an attempt to return voting rights to nonviolent felons. Bill Newman of the American Civil Liberties Union has this report.
If you committed a crime, served your time, completed your sentence, became completely rehabilitated, and a law-abiding contributing member of your community, shouldn't you be allowed to vote? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. The answer, according to the state of Florida, is no. Almost everyone in Florida with a felony record is prevented from voting. Forever. And the Florida legislature thinks this is just fine. After all, those disenfranchised include 25% of Florida's black population, and African Americans historically tend to vote Democratic. And Donald Trump won this crucial swing state by a margin less than one-tenth the number of those disenfranchised voters. Grassroots groups are working to enact the Voter Restoration Amendment that would automatically restore voting rights to nonviolent felons who have completed their sentence. Persons convicted of a violent felony still could not vote. The ballot question faces two hurdles. First, the state Supreme Court must approve the wording of it. And second, supporters somehow have to collect about 750,000 signatures of registered voters before February 2018. That number of signatures is an uphill fight. It's a fight for something Americans and Floridians profess to believe in. We call it democracy. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
After a 10-year stretch without an interest rate increase, the Federal Reserve Board has approved the second rise in 3 months. The rise to a range between 0.75% and 1% was spurred in part by the inflation rate, which rose 2.2% during the last 12 months. Fed Chair Janet Yellen said a wide range of indicators showed the U.S. economy was in rude health. However, the Fed continues to forecast a modestly positive economy, with the unemployment rate remaining at 4.5% and inflation around 2% for the next 3 years. Given President Trump's plans for large spending increases in the military and infrastructure, many financial experts are expecting to see at least two more interest rates rises this year.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. As deportations and raids on undocumented immigrant workers happen across America, it is being resisted by organized labor, immigrant rights groups, clergy, and sanctuary communities. They resist because the vast majority of undocumented workers have committed no other crimes and are simply working and raising their families. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka leaves no doubt which side organized labor is on when it comes to mass deportations.
We will not stand for it. We'll resist it with everything that we have, everywhere that we are, every way that we can, and we refuse to be divided into us versus them.
Trumka says mass deportations violates America's founding principles. Global unemployment is expected to grow substantially this year. The Education International Global Union is trying to do something about it. Radio Labor's C. Marie Ainsborough reports.
More than 60 participants from over 40 countries are meeting in Brussels this week to discuss how to grow employment in the education sector. The conference was organized by Education International. EI is the global union federation which represents teachers and other education workers at the world level. The challenges being addressed by the delegates include contract types and salary scales, collective bargaining rights, and legal assistance for teacher unionists. David Edwards, a deputy general secretary of EI, emphasized the importance of defending the teaching profession, doing what is best for society, and sharing what works with other teachers. Education International is the world's largest federation of unions. It represents more than 32 million education employees who are members of about 400 labor organizations. EI operates in 170 countries and territories.
Public Citizen says nearly half of major construction contracts awarded by the state of Maryland were cited for worker safety violations. Over the past 5 years, 46% of the companies awarded major construction contracts worth $100,000 or more had OSHA safety citations. 35% of those companies had serious safety violations, hazards that could cause accidents that would most likely result in death or serious physical harm. Two of the contractors had workers killed on the job due to safety violations, one worker crushed by improperly placed barriers, and another hit by a car after traffic warning signs were placed thousands of feet farther from her than required by law.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Speaking to auto workers today and executives in Ypsilanti, Michigan, President Trump announced he was ending an Obama executive order that pushed forward fuel efficiency standards. That order would have raised the average to more than 50 miles per gallon by 2025, compared to 27.5 miles per gallon recorded in 2010. The higher standards were projected to provide consumers $98 billion in total net benefits, primarily from reduced fuel use. Besides that loss in savings, other expected results are declining sales of U.S. cars here and abroad in favor of more efficient vehicles made elsewhere and fewer American auto jobs in research and development. Many of the workers at that speech said they had been given paid time off to attend, including many who were brought there by company-chartered buses.
A coalition of cities, states, and regions has pledged to work together to reduce their contribution to climate change. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz of the Yale Center for Environmental Communication has this report.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Even when national governments are slow to act, cities, states, and regions can lead the charge against climate change.
At this level of government, there's a lot more opportunity for a greater degree of flexibility and innovation in the policies that are being developed.
That's Libby Ferguson, States and Regions Director at the Climate Group. This nonprofit works with a coalition of cities, states, and regions worldwide that have pledged to dramatically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions.
We have a wide variety of governments, from rainforest states through to large economic regions in Germany, all setting out how they, in their different regional contexts, will achieve 80 to 95% emissions reduction by 2050.
Participants share knowledge and work together to develop and implement effective policies, and they track progress towards their goals. The coalition is made up of more than 160 local and regional governments from 33 countries and 6 continents. And Ferguson says that more governments are joining all the time.
We see this as just the start.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Salvadorans deported by the U.S. government warn of a looming humanitarian crisis in Central American countries as the Trump administration plows ahead with hardline policies toward immigrants. The Salvadoran Congress has approved a special contingency fund to cope with the needs of deportees, but just how much it can help is in doubt given the economy's dependence on remittances. FSRN's Ricardo Martinez has more.
Airplanes filled with deportees are a common sight at San Salvador's international airport, and they will likely become much more frequent. According to the Ministry of Security and Justice of El Salvador, during January and February of this year, more than 3,200 Salvadorans were deported from the United States. That's a 6.6% increase of last year's levels for the same time period. And if President Donald Trump's rhetoric is any indication, the rate will continue to rise. Ana Bermudez is a young mother who was arrested last month after leaving her work in San Antonio, Texas. Her daughters remain behind in the custody of her undocumented sister. She believes that ramped-up deportation will turn an economic crisis into a humanitarian one.
¿De dónde nuestra familia va a vivir? Porque prácticamente...
How are our families going to get by if they are practically living on the remittances that stabilize the country's economy? For example, in my case, I cannot contribute economically to my family anymore. And here the families are big and there are no job opportunities. I don't know what I'm going to do. All the people that are being deported have been contributing economically, and now what's that going to cause in the country? A humanitarian crisis. We are already in an economic crisis, and then a humanitarian crisis will come. The quality of people's lives will definitely change.
An estimated 1 in 4 Salvadorans live in the United States. Many have temporary or permanent residence, but most live and work without authorization, which puts them in the crosshairs of Trump's deportation policy. For 3 years, Rafael Hidalgo worked in California's construction industry to support his family. He was arrested by immigration authorities and immediately deported in late February. Hidalgo says the deportations caused more than just economic damage.
The separation of parents from their children has a high social cost. Not having parents around at an early age is harmful to a child. It's also doubly damaging to our economy. The deportees will swell the ranks of the unemployed people in this country. And since there are no job opportunities here, as deportations increase, so will the unemployment rate.
In addition to high unemployment, El Salvador is dealing with levels of violence unseen since its civil war years. Gangs control poor neighborhoods and forced recruitment has sent thousands of mothers to flee northward with their children. As the Trump administration cracks down on undocumented immigrants already in the U.S., the prospects for obtaining asylum have also diminished. During the Obama administration, recent border crossers were prioritized for deportation. Salvadoran immigration agent Francisco Diaz says Trump's policy is just an expansion of what was already in place.
What is happening today is a worsening of deportation policies. President Obama was kicking out Salvadoran people one after another. He was deporting 400 to 500 people every month. But what President Trump wants is to send back 400 to 500 people every week or every day. How do we deal with this problem? It's not easy. This is a real aggravation that will worsen the already troubled economy. The national economy could break down, and no emergency aid from the United States will solve the problem.
El Salvador's immigration authorities are putting together emergency plans and programs. The nation Congress has also approved the creation of a special fund to provide legal aid to Salvadorans in the U.S., but many here fear the programs will fall far short of what is needed to cope with the profound effects of deportation in a country where more than a quarter of the population lives abroad. Ricardo Martinez, FSRN, San Salvador.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Raphael, Kanan Schlesinger, and Ray Bodwell. Our producer tonight is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zalis Marchant, and the Evening News Public Affairs Director, or the Evening Public Affairs Director, is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, and you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Call in and join the conversation. At 9, it's Press Watch, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program. At 9 on Fight the Empire, Robert Perry is back to discuss how the Democrats have thrown in with neocons on the issue of Russia. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, we'll hear from Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Between the Covers, we'll welcome author Melissa Phoebos and her novel Abandon Me, a story about how a woman's body and a body of literature hold memory. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
That is correct. It is 5:45 on Wednesday, which means it is once again time for News from the Boo, where we talk about items of interest here in the station and in the greater listening community. The last few News from the Boos have been outstanding. 2 weeks ago, we talked about archiving, which I find fascinating. And this week, we have something that might even be better in my book. And that is, we are going to be talking about sonic IDs. We're joined today by News Director Zalis Marchant and Station Manager Gil Cardone, who are going to be talking about what our initiative is regarding sonic IDs, what they are, what we're trying to accomplish with them, and where we are in the process. So, Gil and Zalis, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Hi, all right, everybody.